We're on episode 5 of our Sunday message series that we're calling Defeating Giants. As we've said, a giant can be, you know, a person who tries to intimidate you and push you around, or it could be a place that makes you feel anxious or uncomfortable. It could be a thing, like a medical diagnosis or a dispute with a friend or a relative. Basically, a giant is anyone or any place or anything that weighs on your heart and crushes your soul. You know, we asked the kids in our middle school ministry last weekend what some of the giants in their lives are. You know what they said as they were sitting on their beanie bags? They said things like guilt, regret, anxiety, anger, and perfectionism. These are just some of the giants our young people are dealing with, and they're pretty heavy duty. And that's why we developed this series. You know, the series, it's designed to equip all of us with strategies to take down the giants in our lives who are trying to hurt, scare, or bother us. And so far, we've talked about 4 pretty specific strategies for doing that. We've talked about perseverance and the importance of sticking it out to the bitter end. We've talked about humility, how humility is important, and how underdogs are victorious only when they use their own unique hidden strengths and don't try to be something that they're not. Cleverness, we talked about last week. It's a core strategy. Using a little trickery on a dumb giant is a time-honored strategy, including in the Bible. And finally, we said that you'll never be able to successfully get rid of a giant in your life unless you're willing to change whatever you need to change about yourself. If you're living in a way that isn't really what God wants for you, it's kind of like fighting these giants with one hand tied behind your back. You won't win. Now, of course, when an evil giant clomps into your life, you might not feel strong enough to take it on. That's a normal reaction. It's why giants often win in the first place. We've come to believe that strength and power are the only ways to win, and that's just not true. In fact, what we're going to talk about tonight is that your weakness might be the very thing that God uses to take down a giant. You see, most people believe that a disadvantage or a weakness is something to be avoided, you know, because it puts you at a competitive disadvantage compared to other people. Conventional wisdom holds that we should play off our strengths and downplay our shortcomings. That school of thought is called capitalization learning. We capitalize on what we're good at and ignore the rest. It's the idea that we get good at something by focusing on our strengths and ignoring what we're not good at. But here's the thing, sometimes working with disadvantages is precisely what will give you the advantage, because it requires you to confront your limitations and find creative ways to compensate for them. That school of thought is called compensation learning. When you have no choice but to work through a disability or weakness, it makes you stronger because you have to deal with failure and develop skills other people don't have. For example, a man named David Boies is one of the most famous trial lawyers in the world. In 2010, he was selected as one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine. I came in, I was the runner-up, but no one mentioned that. Anyway, David, as great as he is, as the world's greatest trial lawyer, he has a weakness, and it's a big one. He struggles to read. In fact, he didn't begin to read until the 3rd grade because, as he later learned, he has dyslexia. And if you know about the legal profession, you know that it requires a tremendous amount of reading. So how did David become this world-class litigator if he can't really read that well? Well, he had to find a workaround, a shortcut, to bypass his difficulty in reading. And over the years, he's been able to sharpen other skills, like his ability to listen to his professors in law school, to listen to the what the witnesses said on the witness stand, and to remember what people told him. And today, he uses those skills to win cases. While most lawyers, you know, have their noses in the casebooks and they overcomplicate things, David, because of his limitation, is able to simplify the issues down to their basics and present a common case, a common sense case to judges and juries. And he wins. That's called compensation learning. And it can be just the thing that helps an underdog claim the victory. And I think that compensation learning is precisely what also transformed the first followers of Jesus from unremarkable individuals to extraordinary apostles. You know, the very first thing that Jesus did when he started, launched his public ministry, was to choose his closest disciples who one day would go out into the world and spread his name to the ends of the earth. It began with Peter and his brother Andrew, and then two other fishermen, James and John, and then one by one, Jesus selected those who would follow in his footsteps. And then he spent 3 years preparing them for the hardship of ministry that lay ahead, and he did it in 4 ways. First, he recruited the 12 apostles from really tough backgrounds. 4 were fishermen. 1 was a political activist, no stranger to violence. And another was a tax collector, a noted sinner. None of these men came from aristocracy. They were not lords or gentlemen or royalty. Jesus chose men who worked by the sweat of their brow, most of them, because he wanted his successors to have grit and resilience. Then he took them and he immersed them in difficult environments. He took them into hostile territories. Along the way, they confronted severely ill people, many of whom were contagious, and individuals possessed by demons. If you've ever faced a demon, trust me, you don't want to. He also forced the disciples to learn through trial and error. This wasn't a classroom experience with high theory. No, early on, Jesus sent them out on an internship. He sent them out alone into towns and villages to go heal people, to exorcise demons, and to proclaim the kingdom of God. And they failed a lot. In fact, one time Jesus saw them trying to heal a young boy, and when they couldn't, he became exasperated with them and basically yelled at them. But perhaps most importantly, Jesus prepared his apostles for the hardship of ministry by warning them what to expect. "I'm sending you like sheep in the midst of wolves," he said once. Over and over, you know, he reminded them that following him required constant sacrifice, you know, taking up your cross. He told them that they needed a sense of urgency and a total radical commitment to the cause because times would be tough in the future, and without that commitment, they would never make it through. And in the gospel passage today, Jesus issues another warning to prepare his disciples for the unimaginable. So let's take a look at that story. It begins with a group of people who are standing around the temple, admiring this beautiful temple in Jerusalem. And it was a very impressive structure. It had a solid gold facade, and it had these massive white stones that made it look like a snow-covered mountain from a distance. But instead of joining in the accolades, Jesus rather ominously said, "Hey, all that you see here, one day, it's all going to be rubble. All these stones are going to come tumbling down, and it won't be very far in the future." He was predicting the total destruction of the temple. And to say that that prophecy was troubling would have been a massive understatement. The fall of the temple would be like the end of the world for the Jewish people back then. In their view, the temple was located at the very center of the universe. It was quite literally the meeting point between heaven and earth. Every aspect of the temple mirrored God's creation intentionally, from the inner sanctum known as the Holy of Holies that represented heaven, to the four colors of a massive, enormous veil that symbolized the four elements of earth, water, air, and fire, to the seven-branched candlestick known as the menorah that signified the seven known planets at that time. And so the temple's destruction would be an utter disaster, ending all Jewish worship as they had known it for over 1,000 years. And when the disciples ask when all this is going to happen and what signs they should look for, he warns them again. He says, look, don't get deceived, okay? There's going to be people coming after me saying, I'm the real Messiah. And he says, don't follow them. And then he was right. There were plenty of messianic pretenders back then. And every one of those movements was stamped out by the authorities. But then Jesus reveals the biggest warning of all. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. And then he uses this apocalyptic language that's sort of meant to be taken figuratively. He says there'll be powerful earthquakes and famines and plagues and mighty signs in the sky. And he was not wrong. He was not wrong. In the year 66 AD, the Jewish people rebelled against the Roman Empire that had been occupying their land for over 100 years and oppressing the people. And Rome itself, at that time, had been going through a very difficult period of time, a great time of political instability. You might remember from your world history that a fire destroyed 70% of the city of Rome in just 6 days, and Emperor Nero was blamed for the disaster. A revolt quickly spread, and Nero was declared public enemy number one. He fled from the city, and that left a power vacuum. And so rival generals began moving their troops towards Rome, and it looked like there would be civil war. What did Jesus say? Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. He was not wrong. For an empire that had prided itself on peace and stability, it was like the apocalypse had come to Rome itself, just as Jesus had described. And then, a few years later, the Romans, desperate to put down the Jewish rebellion, came into Jerusalem. They destroyed the city and they burned the temple to the ground, and it has never been rebuilt. Also, just as Jesus predicted. But then Jesus gives them some more bad news. He says, before all this happens, they're going to seize you. They're going to persecute you. They're going to lead you before kings and governors. They're going to hand you over to synagogues. They're going to put you into prison. And the worst part of it, he says, is that their own friends and relatives would be the ones to hand them over to the authorities. And it all happened exactly as he said. It's a fact. It's a historical fact. So how, you may be asking, how did the apostles survive all that? What got them through the persecution, the rejection, and the other hardships? It was the gritty preparation that Jesus put them through. It paid off in the end. Having suffered repeated rejection, being forced to face down demons, to scrounge up food for thousands of people in the wilderness, battle ferocious storms on the Sea of Galilee, and trudge across the countryside for hundreds of miles at a time, it made them stout-hearted and resolute in their ministry. They failed over and over again, only to be corrected and scolded and rebuked by Jesus. And that made the kings and the courts and the prisons look like child's play. After 3 years on the road with Jesus, they could handle anything. In fact, there's every reason to believe that Jesus chose these flawed, mediocre, and unrefined men precisely because of their disadvantaged background. He knew that they would develop the grit that they needed. Cultured, sophisticated, learned, lettered men, they wouldn't have stood a chance. No, it was the disciples' weaknesses that ultimately gave them the advantage that they needed to get through what lay ahead. You might come from humble beginnings, or what you think is a checkered past. Maybe you struggle, like David Boies, to learn, or you have some sort of disability in learning. Or maybe you feel uncomfortable in social situations. Maybe you have a hard time making friends or don't know how to fit in. Perhaps you think you're weak in faith and far from God. Or you might not have a lot of money or social and political connections. Someone may have hurt you when you were young and you haven't gotten over it. Or you might have a physical or mental condition that seems to limit your potential. But each of these disadvantages could very well be your winning strategy. I don't have a story, you know, like I didn't have dyslexia or anything like that, but I'll tell you something I am ashamed of and that I see as a disadvantage. When I was a young man, I was confused and I couldn't figure out what I wanted to do in life. Like most young people, I couldn't figure out my path, but it took me like 20 years to figure it out. If you've read my bio, you know that's true. I hopped from one thing to the next while others in my peer group, you know, seemed to have it figured out. And they settled down into careers, had a family, and lived in a community. They were stable while I was trying to figure myself out. And I've always been a little ashamed of the time that I wasted. It was definitely a disadvantage for me, at least in my eyes. I was the oldest in my class at law school, and the other students never hesitated to remind me of that fact. And when I went to seminary, I had to claw my way in. I had to prove and show that even though I was older and had tried many things, that yes, this indeed was the thing that was going to stick. And it has. And I, when I got into the seminary, I always admired and felt a little inferior to the young men in their 20s, you know, who came to their vocation, figured out that God was calling them to be a priest early in life, and they never wavered. But the funny thing is that today, people often tell me that the variety of my life experiences, the many things I've done, is precisely what has made me a better priest than maybe I would have otherwise been. I don't know if that's true. I hope there's some truth in that. But my point is, for you, whatever giant you're facing, don't count yourself down and out because you feel disadvantaged or weak in some way. Every underdog feels that way. That's why they're the underdog. But disadvantages, difficulties, limitations, they can be helpful, even desirable. And they may be the very thing that clinches the victory for you. I think St. Paul put it the best when he said, "I am content with weaknesses and insults and hardships and persecutions and constraints for the sake of Christ. For when I am weak, then I am strong."